Well, good morning. A little unfinished music there from Chelsea Berry on Greg Virgo's Unfinished Music Studio Stuff. This is Trending Now with Josh Arnold and our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky. I'm Rick Moore. And hey, Josh.
Hello there.
What's up?
Well, we have a very nice lineup today. Susan Wardick is our an award-winning radio and TV news anchor. Will be our first guest. Brian LaPierre, the city councilor in Lynn, will be our second guest. And Dave Gardner, who was sworn in last night as Rotary District 7930's district governor, will be our third guest.
Okay, all that coming up and more here on MSO News Sports. This is Trending Now. We'll be right back.
Score early and often this fall with a low-rate residential loan from the Institution for Savings. The Institution for Savings has fantastic rates, low or no fees, great service and prompt turnaround. Plus, we service our mortgages in-house, so help is always a local phone call away. For more information or to apply online 24/7, visit institutionforsavingsloans.com or call us at 978-462-2344. Institution for Savings, member FDIC and DIF, equal housing lender.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodwright double-hung insert window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodwright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our first guest is Susan Wardick.
Susan, welcome to the program. Start out and tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll have some questions to talk about.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for your interest in talking to me. You know, when you retire from a very public job, like a television reporter and anchor, you sort of think that nobody really knows if you're dead or alive, and nobody really cares. And so it's really nice that you guys remember me, so thank you very much. Here's what happens when you retire from such a public job. You go places, and people look at you, and they sort of get up in your face, and they stare at you because they think you look familiar, but they're not really sure who you are. A woman a few weeks ago, I was in an elevator with her, and she looked at me, and she said, "Hi, hi," and I said, "Hi." She said, "How are you?" And I said, "I'm great. How are you?" And she said, "Great." And I said, "Do you know who I am?" She said, "No, no." I said, "You want to take a shot at it?" She said, "Did you sell me a house back in the late 80s? It was just so funny. So I said, "Yes, I hope you and your family are still happy there." But so I did. I had this wonderful, amazing career on Channel 5, WCVB-TV in Boston, for the better part of 35 years as an anchor of the midday newscast and a fill-in anchor of the other newscasts, and the chief investigative consumer reporter. And I had a wonderful opportunity to feel like I was really making a difference every day, helping people who otherwise, you know, didn't have an advocate. And also, you know, delivering information to people that was the main responsibility that we had. So at, you know, after so many years and so many wonderful experiences, it was time to retire. I knew it, and I did. Wow. Now I live in Stuart, Florida, which is, if you look at a map of the east coast of Florida, and if you find Palm Beach, go up about an inch, and then you find Stuart. And I live here with my mom. She lives with me. She's 102 years old, wow, and a billion, in great shape, and I still have a few jobs in the Boston area, and I go back and forth regularly, so my roots and my life still are largely in Boston. My heart will always be in Boston, but I'm having a great time here also taking care of my mom. And that was a very long-winded answer to the question that you probably forgot you even asked 10 minutes ago.
Are you from the area originally?
When I was about 10 years old, my parents moved to Needham from Cleveland. And we lived in Needham for about 8 or 9 months. Very ironically, very ironically, hold on 1 second, please.
Sure.
What do you need, Mom? What do you need? Here, it's right here. I'm sorry, guys, but this is part of my life.
This is live radio. We love it. It's excellent.
I know, yeah. Exactly. It's live. I should put her on so she could say hello, too. Actually, she's waving. She's good. My parents, coincidentally, moved to Needham, and who knew that years later I'd be working a mile away. We lived in Needham for about a year, and then they moved to Natick, and that's where I really feel like I'm from, Natick. And I say to people all the time, I am living proof that there was a Natick before Doug Flutie.
There you go. Yes, famous by Ms. Warnick. A long time ago, I started at a little radio station in Salem, Massachusetts, and there was a fire. And on my first day on the job covering news, Channel 5 was there. It was Jack Hines at that time. I don't know if you were there at that time. It might have been a little before your time. But
no, Jack was still there when I started back in 1980. He was there for, I want to say, maybe a year or so while I was there.
Well, that was my first year, and I was at this fire scene in Beverly, and Jack Hines was there, and I had no idea what I was doing because I was a full-time teacher, and I was a part-time summer replacement at this radio station, but they sent me to cover the fire. So I'm outside the roped-off area, and Jack Hines, he's got his Channel 5 shirt on. It's a hot summer day, and he comes over, and he sees that I'm lost. He shakes my hand, and he says, "Hi, I'm Jack Hines." Like, I didn't know who he was. But then he took me inside the lines and showed me around. And I've talked to Mike Lynch a lot. I know him from Swampscott when he was a basketball coach. And he was talking about the people at Channel 5 who mentored him. And I'm wondering if you have a story like that, and if you, as you became a veteran, saw younger people come in, and not that they weren't polished, but that maybe you could give them a hint here and there. Anything like that?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things about Channel 5 was we had a motto that we used on the air, and it was, "We are family to New England." And, you know, a lot of people at the time said, "Well, that's really corny." The truth is, we were family to New England because we were family to each other. You know, like you just alluded to, Mike Lynch is from Swampscott, me most of my life from Natick, Dick Albert, the Newton area, Natalie Wellesley, Chet spent so many years in the greater Boston area. We all grew up here. It was a part of our, you know, our past, and we all opted to stay here rather than leave and go to bigger markets or the network, a lot of us. So we really did feel that kinship. When I got to Channel 5, I was working full-time in radio. I was in the late 70s at WBZ Radio for a period of time, and then moved over to what was then WHDH Radio. Mm-hmm. And so I was working full-time at HDH Radio, and I got to know a lot of the full-time Channel 5 reporters, producers, and photographers, and the late, great Jim Thistle, who was then the news director at Channel 5. He would go out on stories with the crews, and that's how I met him. Plus, he was friends with my boss, the radio, news director at WHDH Radio, the amazing and wonderful Ed Bell. To whom I give so much, all the credit, frankly, for my career. He's a guy you should have on your podcast. Actually, we'll talk about that because Eddie lives in Marblehead now. Anyway, so Eddie introduced me to Jim Thistle, and Jim and I talked And I met the other reporters from Channel 5, and he was the one who said, "You know, why don't you come over here and do some part-time work on television?" And I said, no, I don't want to work on television. I'll have to comb my hair, you know. And he was wonderful to me, as were all the other reporters. Martha Bradley at the time, who's now Martha Raddatz, an important reporter for ABC News, and author of several, you know, other important pieces, not just books, but papers and news and articles, is still one of my best friends. And, Clark Booth took me under their wings and did help me in many different ways. And so it was always important to me to pass that down. And when we would get interns from different colleges in the area, it was important to all of us to try to help those young people as best as we could.
Great. That's it's so good to know. I mean, I've had great feelings. Channel, I'm a veteran. I've been around a while. I'm not going to tell you when I graduated from high school, but Channel 5 is still our favorite, although it's changed so much. And I just have one more question. I'll give it back to Josh. But how did you actually get started in media, either you know after high school, after college? How did it begin for you?
I was lucky. And seriously, I was very, very lucky. I had wonderful teachers at Natick High School who took an interest in me personally. I was not a great student. I didn't have the grades to get into a good college, but I had a couple of teachers who saw that I had great potential as a communicator, and they said, you should go to Emerson College because that's a terrific communication school. I applied. I was very quickly rejected. I was not even put on a waiting list. They didn't even want to know my middle name. And so this was back in 1967 when I graduated from high school. That means that I'm 67 years old. I'll save you the trouble of trying to do the math. And my father just wasn't going to take no for an answer. And he, you know, times were very different. And he went down to Emerson College, which was then located on Beacon Street in Boston, made an appointment to see, you know, the head of admissions. And he just said, you got to take her. Please take her. Because I don't know what we're going to do with her if you don't take her. And, you know, he said, I'll pay her tuition up front. I'll do whatever you want, but please. So they came up with an agreement, I think, just to get my father out of the office, that if I took summer courses and passed, that they would accept me. So I did, and they did, and my initial major was speech pathology and audiology, only because it was about communications, and I was flunking out after 2 weeks. And my psychology professor, again, I was lucky. He took an interest in me. He said, you're flunking out. Why? I told him I just wasn't interested in what I was studying. He said, what interests you? I said, psychology. So he put together an independent study program, which allowed me to not only work at my own pace and with him, but I eventually made Dean's List and graduated from Emerson College, one of the best communication schools in the country, with a major in psychology and a minor, you know, in history and another minor in English. And then I wanted to further my education. I moved up to New Hampshire with the thought that I would get my master's and get a job in social services. I got up to New Hampshire, discovered there were no social services, so I needed a job. And I got a job selling advertising at the proverbial 5,000-watt radio station, WFEA, which no longer exists, I don't think. It was in Merrimack, New Hampshire, and that's how it started. And I just, I loved selling advertising, but more than that, I just loved the whole radio scene, and I loved the news department, and I met the people in the news department. The owner of the station was from New York, and he thought, you know what, let's do something really crazy. This is like 1974 or 5. He said, let's put a girl on the radio. And he said, Susan, I want you to read a newscast. And that was how it started. There is a book published on the history of radio in New Hampshire. And in that book, it says that I am the first woman to have held a full-time job in radio in New Hampshire.
Wow.
Honestly, I don't know if that's true or not. But that's how it started.
Sounds good.
They liked the way I sounded, and one newscast turned into a full-time news job.
That's great. Listen, you know, it's funny. I had, like, a whole bunch of questions here.
Yeah.
And you've answered, like, five of them.
I'm long-winded.
When
you start me, you can't stop me.
No, it's great. I like the blend of information. I had done some research. I knew that you had started out in speech pathology, and I was interested in what the transition was. You know, you mentioned, and I saw this in a prior print interview you had done, when you said, I was lucky. You came out of a different educational setting into journalism and made a go of it. And not only made a go of it as a career, but as an award-winning and an acclaimed journalist. What are the chances that happens today? And I contrast that because there are quote-unquote news shows that feature anchors or hosts that, you know, have no background in news or journalism, but present as a news show. And you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, thank you for the compliment. When I say I was lucky, I really truly was, because I always had wonderful mentors who took an interest in me, whether they were teachers or coworkers or bosses. And they gave me opportunities that, you're right, it was a very different time. But it was important in that we, those of us who were starting out, were given a lot of freedom to grow. And what happened, I think, to the business is that as television became more and more popular and viewers, you know, the viewership and the audience grew, younger people who started watching television saw it as glamorous, which it really, it for me especially, and for those of us at Channel 5, we never really thought of it that way. But I think that aspiring younger people, how can I put this, rather than becoming aspiring journalists, there was a generation who just wanted to be on television.
Yeah.
And so that became more important to them than the actual pursuit of journalism. And that presented a gray area that was hard, I think, for some seasoned journalists to accept. The question that you ask, I mean, we could do a whole week-long seminar about that. A lot has changed. And what I say to people now is that you have to be very conscious of who you're watching, what station you're watching, what person you're watching, because journalists and editorial writers and columnists and essayists all get painted with the same brush now. And when you sit back on your couch and you have a clicker and you're just, you know, surfing all the channels, it's very hard to know if you're watching a legitimate news show that's sponsored by a well-respected and accepted network, or if you're watching a cable show that is simply brought to you by an advertiser who has no real interest in journalism. I really believe that it's up to the viewing public to educate themselves about what they're watching and who they're watching, because otherwise it's very easy to be misled.
You mentioned that on election night. I was the night before the presidential election and then the night of the election. I was channel surfing, and I was watching, you know, the returns come in on six channels and you know, flicking back and forth who has what story and so forth. And what surprised me was the difference in what the stories were. Not only what states were won, who was winning, who was losing, and how that all played out, but it was like Rod Serling wrote the script for this. It was that that bizarre. This couldn't really happen, and yet it was. And yet I was watching it. In 1985, we were doing special assignment reporting, and you. As a local reporter, and then you came into a national spotlight for a story that you were covering, and I believe it had to do with corruption in a local police department here in Massachusetts. And you came into the spotlight because you protected the source of your information, and that cast you into a national spotlight. Can you walk us through what that was like? As much as you care to share about the story, and then how the story shifted from being about the corruption and to you not wanting to reveal that source.
Well, again, thank you for mentioning that and remembering it, because it was a remarkable time for me. I worked with a wonderful photojournalist whose name is Stanley Foreman, who still works at Channel 5. He started at the old Record American, you know, 420 years ago. Stanley won't look at me saying that, but it's true. And
I remember the Record American.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He moved from print to electronic into television journalism, and he and I worked together a lot. And he got actually the tip about a story that involved six Revere police officers who allegedly went to a CVS ostensibly to investigate an alarm, and the allegation was that when they got there, they looted the store. And so we started working on that story, and one day when I got off the air after reporting on it, I got a call in the newsroom from a guy who said, I was there, I saw it. And I said, oh, will you do an interview with me? And he said, no, I'm afraid of retribution from the Revere cops because I live in Revere. So I promised him, no one will ever know who your name is or anything else. And he went ahead and he did the interview with me and Stanley and gave us very good information. The state police who were investigating the Revere police needed that information. And they asked me for the guy's name after they saw the interview on the air. And I said, no, I can't give you his name. I promised him anonymity. What happened was that I called the witness. I told him that the state police wanted to speak to him. So he called the state police, and he was as helpful as he could be without giving his name. But then when the state police had enough evidence to bring before a grand jury, they needed this guy's name so that they could call him to testify. But they didn't know his name. But I knew his name, so they brought me before the grand jury and asked me the guy's name. And when I refused, they brought me before a judge, and that judge found me in contempt of court when I refused to divulge the witness's identity. And it just became huge news because I was sentenced to 90 days of what was then MCI Framingham. And it was completely stunning to me, but I had no choice. Everybody says, oh, you did the right thing, you did the right thing. I had no choice. I mean, I had made this promise to this man, and there was no way I was going back on that. And if it meant that I had to go to jail, well, then I didn't want to. I was scared to death of going to jail, but then that was what I had to do. Eventually, the man came forward on his own. It became such big news that, you know, in 1985, a female reporter or a reporter of any sex or age was going to jail in America, that media outlets from all over the country, and especially Boston, paid very close attention, and it was front page news. And all the television stations were covering it, and the witness saw that I was headed to jail, and he felt so bad about that, that he was responsible, that he came forward and he identified himself. He testified before the grand jury, and the case moved forward, and so the charges against me became moot, and they were dropped, and so I never had to go to jail. But it was a terrifying time for me, because I had never, you know, I was very lucky in that I'd never even been sick, confined to a bed or, you know, home for any length of time. And to think I was going to jail was, you know, beyond my reality. And it was an opportunity also for me to be on the other side of the story. Instead of covering the story, I was the story. And I was able to see how people who are newsmakers are sometimes treated by the media. And that gave me a very unique perspective into my job.
That's great. Now, we had Kim Carrigan on the show not that long ago, and I raised an issue with her in which I said that I had seen an interview with Megyn Kelly, and she was doing pitching her book and so forth, and she talked about harassment and so forth, and she said, of course, when I was harassed, I didn't look like I do now. I wasn't, quote-unquote, foxified. And so I threw that, I asked her about that, and I said, what is your sense of being in broadcast journalism, and how much has there been a shift to create a particular picture of what that anchor looks like or should look like on some stations and so forth. And I raised the question, do the men and women pick out their own clothing, or does somebody pick that out for them and that kind of thing? Any thoughts to share along those lines?
Well, first of all, I love Kim. I just think Kim is terrific. And she and I actually do a radio segment together, or I should say I do a radio segment on her show every Wednesday morning at 9:30 on WRKO. I do consumer issues, brought to you by Rubino and Lang. Just don't lose the money, guys, who I work with. They're one of the people I work with in Boston. So she's terrific, and I would love to hear how she answered the question. I can only speak from my experience, of course, and Channel 5. Nobody told me what to wear. As far as I know, nobody told the other female anchors or male anchors what to wear either. At Channel 5, we, in the early days, all were very conscious of the fact that we did not ever want to bring attention to ourselves and away from the story. And so we dressed in a very conservative way. And it didn't matter if you were a man or a woman. You wore a jacket on the air. You wore some sort of a suit, and it was probably considered very, well, definitely for these days, it was conservative. There was not any chance in the world that you would show your arms, that you would wear anything sleeveless, if you were a man or a woman, but especially, you know, women. And that changed over the years at Channel 5, as the dress codes were non-existent, really, but the styles seemed to be more and more, I'm going to use the word revealing, because there was more revealing of human skin, which when I started out in the business, my gosh, people were lucky if they saw your neck.
Yeah.
So that has changed a lot for sure.
Well, and the other thing you mentioned, that, you know, what has changed is the reporter becoming the story, and we've got these disc jockeys on the air like Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity, who are are entertainers, but they're not journalists. Just my opinion. But, you know, you mentioned your age. You sound youthful. You've got the fire in the belly. You're still working. What's in the future for you? Because I know that you're probably, with all your experience, just hitting your stride.
You know, thank you again. You guys are so sweet. Thank you. Yes, I've got these wonderful opportunities in Boston. Benchmark Senior Living is a terrific organization. They have senior living communities throughout New England, and I've been working with them. One of the things with my mom that I have learned firsthand is that it is very unique to care for somebody who's older, and especially a parent. And, you know, nobody warns us, nobody educates us, nobody tells us what to expect. And so thanks to the people at Benchmark, I travel around the area and do seminars talking about my experiences, and it helps to educate people. And then Ron Bonvy Holmes is an over 55, he's a builder of over 55 communities, and so it's another opportunity for me to help people know what their options are, because as we age, there are so many things that we have to face that nobody really warns us about or tells us about. And so my years on Channel 5 as a consumer reporter were filled with gratification that I could really feel like I was helping people, as I said at the beginning of our interview and our conversation. And that's what I'm doing now, but in a different way. When I was at Channel 5, I was telling people, don't do this. Don't waste your money on this. Don't, you know, be scammed by these people. Now what I'm doing is I'm saying this is how you should spend your money. This is how you should save your money. This is what you should look into. It's all positive things that help my generation and, frankly, your generations, too, as we approach a time of our lives that should be pleasant and should be stress-free. And if we plan the right way and if we have the right information, we can plan the right way. And that's what I'm doing now. So in many ways, I just feel like this is the best time of my life. I still do all the charity things that I love doing in Boston, and I travel, like I said earlier. Let's just put it this way. If I don't have my own terminal for JetBlue, I should certainly have my own gate, because I am a Mosaic member and then some. I think I'm on more flights than some of their flight attendants. But it's just great. It's all wonderful for me, and I feel so lucky.
Well, make sure you write a book about your memoirs when you get tired of traveling.
Now, one of those seminars that you were doing, that's where you met my wife, Teresa.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It was a Benchmark community just a couple of weeks ago. It was wonderful to meet her, Josh. It was great.
When I was putting the question together, and I came across one of the ads you do with Bob LaBelle. I don't know if it was MeTV or something else, but you got there's a dog in the picture with you. Is that a Bichon?
Yes, it's my little Sammy who's sitting right here next to me right now.
All right, we had a Bichon for 15, 16 years, and they just they consume you. But it was I tell the story about. The dog letting the ball roll under the couch and barking for me to come get it. But if you can picture a Bichon, that seems pretty. Anyway, we got a few more minutes. You've given awards for different things in radio and in television. What stuck out? A story that that. Really stuck in your mind that you covered. Maybe it was one that you didn't want to cover, or maybe it was one that made a huge difference in someone's life. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, there were many of them. Honestly, there really were, but probably the one was the most recent, and it was important in me making the decision and knowing it was time to retire. It was a Haiti earthquake. And in that earthquake, a local woman, young woman, Brittany Gangle, was killed. She was a college student in Florida. Her parents were from Rutland, Massachusetts. She was on a summer, well, not summer, a winter break doing a humanitarian effort in Haiti. She was there about a day and a half and perished. Hours before the earthquake hit, she had sent her mother a text saying, "It's amazing here. I love the people. They have nothing. They work so hard to get nowhere, but they have so much love. And when I graduate, I'm going to come back here and I'm going to build an orphanage." You know, and then a few hours later, she was dead. Well, her parents built that orphanage. You know, her father said, "I'm going to live my daughter's dream." And we all covering the story said, "Oh, the poor guy, you know, he's just heartbroken and he's delirious. There's no way he's building an orphanage in Haiti." But he did. And that orphanage opened 3 years ago, and he established Be Like Brit, which is a home for 66 children. I'm on the board. I've been to Haiti several times. It was life-changing for me covering that story and meeting Len and Cheryl and Gangle and their family. And I joke that I've changed my name to Susan Warnick Gangle because I'm just so proud to be, you know, helping in any way that I can. So that was a story that taught me everything very quickly about life and death and love and sharing and commitment and gratitude. And I knew then that there was a bigger purpose for me and more opportunities for me to try to help in a different way than anchoring a newscast and reporting on television. So that helped me to sort of clear my head in terms of my future at then I was about 63 years old.
Well, just so we get the age thing here, I work with Rick. I had Rick as a teacher.
Yes, you did.
But we're not that far apart in age. But,
okay.
Anyway, thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. We could have had the whole hour. I mean, there's so much to talk about. And,
well, thank you, guys. Thank you, as I said at the beginning, for just even for caring. And if there's ever anything that I can do for you, please don't hesitate, or anybody who's listening, because, as I said, my heart, my roots, my life really is still in Boston and always will be.
Thank you, Susan. Take care. Have a
good
weekend.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was amazing.
What a great interview.
You don't get all of that personality watching 2 or 3 minute reports, needless to say. She's always come across as genuine. I've been a Channel 5 fan since I've been in Massachusetts, and as I said, Jack Hines, you know, he took me under his wing and mentored me, and it was like Jack. My jaw was dropping when he did it. I was in my early 20s, and I was a high school math teacher, and he was this storied journalist. But all the guys at Channel 5 and ladies, just tremendous. What a genuine person. I had idea that she was so accomplished in so many different ways.
I had seen her speak. When I was part of the Red Cross, I was on the board of directors of one of the local chapters of the Red Cross, and they have the Heroes Breakfast at Danvers Port, and mm-hmm. she was often the keynote speaker at those, and just did a tremendous job.
Well, yeah, I can see that. Well, great, great job.
Yeah,
great interview. Glad you had her on. Maybe sometime in the future you could ask her if she could come back, because we could certainly devote a whole hour. She's
a great
storyteller.
Yeah.
All right, we'll be right back.
Score early and often this fall with a low-rate residential loan from the Institution for Savings. The Institution for Savings has fantastic rates, low or no fees, great service and prompt turnaround. Plus, we service our mortgages in-house, so help is always a local phone call away. For more information or to apply online 24/7, visit institutionforsavingsloans.com or call us at 978-462-2344. Institution for Savings, member FDIC and DIF, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Brian LaPierre, who is a city councilor at large in the city of Lynn. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, Josh. Nice to be here with you on this holiday weekend.
I usually start out, and I know you've been on our show before, but for the listening audience, give us the three or four minute bio, and then we can get into and talk a little bit about politics.
Sure, I'd love to. You know, I'm Brian LaPierre, as you said. I'm currently on the Lynn City Council. I serve, just concluding, winding up my first term in public office here in the great city of Lynn. I'm a, born and raised here, Lynner. Grew up in East Lynn, on Chatham Street near Sanderson Avenue and Seymour Avenue. Most people refer to that as the Kylie Park area, where I sort of cut my teeth and learned a lot about my neighborhood and my community. Started a neighborhood crime watch, was the head of a Little League, well, Lynn Shore Little League back then. I was actually one of the youngest in the country to ever serve as a president of a local Little League. And as I went on to school in Lynn, I attended the Brickett Elementary and Marshall Middle School, which was formerly known as Eastern Junior High School, and then went on to be a graduate of Lynn English High School before doing my higher education over at Salem State College. You know, I've got a Bachelor of Science in Political Science, a master's degree in education, and then a CAGS degree, the Certificate of Advanced Graduate Studies in Ed Leadership over at Salem as well. In my professional life, I mean, that's a little personal life. I'm also a husband. I'm married to my wonderful wife, Kelly LaPierre, who's an eighth grade teacher here at Pickering Middle School. I'm the dad of two boys, 10 and 6, Owen and Dylan. I'm an educator myself. I taught 11 years in the Lynn Public Schools. I'm a taxpayer, being a homeowner here and a neighbor and a community leader as well, but on the professional end of things, I've spent the last 9 years working with the State Federation of Teachers at the American Federation of Teachers here in Massachusetts, throughout the state as the director of organization for that fine organization. I'm also a realty, a licensed real estate salesperson, and as I said, I morphed that or parlayed that into a successful bid for city council just 2 years ago, and we're running for re-election. We're really excited about what's happening in Lynn right now.
That's great. We I did the CAGS program at leadership at Salem State too. I was in educational administration back in the last century.
Well, two names, Ann Murray and Bill Hoyt. They are just exceptional people and wonderful folks who ran that program for several years over at the college.
I had them both, and Joan Conley and a few others as well. But, yeah, those were great.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Wanted to we look at Lynn, and I know that there's development issues going on there. I know that you just got through a budget process. Share some thoughts with the listening audience about what's involved in those and what has been and continues to be the issues on the forefront.
Oh, I'd love to. You know, Lynn is sort of a work in progress, I say, and emphasize progress. We just had the Lynn Ferry reinstated this summer, so you can take that off of the Lynnway at the harbor site there, where you can take it from the Blossom Street extension into Boston in 20 minutes to a half hour, be from seaport to Boston in that amount of time. So we're very proud of that effort. That's going to run through September 22nd. We've got new construction that's ready to open in less than a month. It's the Market Basket, a big grocery store down on Federal Street and Western Avenue on 107. That's going to employ 400 local job owners in the city of Lynn, and it's going to really be a real infusion of economic growth for us. It's a big, big development. I think it's about a $20 million project, and we're very happy to cut that ribbon come early August. Also, I would mention in terms of new restaurants, we've got the District 45 on 45 Lewis Street, right along 1A, heading towards Swampscott and Marblehead. That's a brand-new restaurant opening this weekend, Josh. So it's a real upscale, nice place, the steak and chicken seafood type of venue, a nice bar, craft brewery. It's really going to have some of the great tastings on the North Shore opening up, District 45. Check that out. We've got an $80 million project, the largest the city has seen in quite some time, over on the North Harbor site. It's formerly known as the Beacon Chevrolet site. That's going to be market-rate apartments. That shovel is going in the ground this November, December, and that's going to be a year or so before it opens and cuts the ribbon, but it'll be a concierge, it'll be a pool there for the residents, big deluxe apartments, luxury apartments, I should say, both one and two bedrooms. They'll have a boardwalk stretched from what we call Seaport Landing on the Linway across from North Shore Community College all the way down to that ferry site I mentioned. It's a great development. We're very happy to bring something to the waterfront in Lynn. And then in our downtown, it's really picked up, Josh. We've got luxury apartments now, again, going in at the Flatiron Building called The Vault. On the ground level, there'll be that concept of retail with the Pie and Pint restaurant, which is going to be a pizza and craft brewery. And there's also going to be Brew on the Grid coffee shop, like a high-end Starbucks type. And that's ready to open the next month. And I said the North Shore Community College expansion program. We've got some affordable housing and mixed housing going in on the Gateway Project, which is Sagamore and Sachem Street, more apartments going in there. So we're trying to balance residences with things to do with retail on the bottom level, and we're trying to capitalize on the success of things like the Lynn Auditorium with great venues and shows and acts coming to town, coupled with good dining options like the Blue Ox and RF O'Sullivan's and Rossetti's, a great Italian restaurant, along with Domici's and April's in downtown Lynn. So many things are happening. We're trying to generate revenue from all these projects. We're also, we've got the booming arts and cultural district, as you know, in the central square area of Lynn. We have the Lynn Museum, Lynn Arts. We've got Raw Arts, the School of Hard Rock. And we're all anchored by our Lynn Auditorium, as I mentioned. And finally, I just mentioned there's a real hot brewery that's going in, and it's celebrating a year or two anniversary called Bevwater, and that's on the Linway. And they've been able to bring food trucks to their establishment. They've been brewing, and you can get canned beers all across at Cappy's on down to different various liquor stores and beer marts that will host Bevwater Brewery. And it's a wonderful addition. We've also got food trucks, as I mentioned, down on the Mount Vernon Street area, Walloon's chicken food truck. And Beyond Walls is a concept that's going to truly and literally light up the downtown landscape with neon lighting under the railroad bridge and down the Washington Street corridor over to Monroe Street with all this neon sort of brightening, safe, and make a priority of safety around our downtown. It's really going to illuminate the whole downtown business district and arts and cultural center. We've got a lot happening, as you heard in that minute or two, and we just want to continue that progress as we run for re-election this summer and fall.
What we have a few minutes left. What were some of the challenges the council faced with the budget this year in getting that through?
Yeah, I mean, the mayor's budget reflected a $9.7 million deficit. We've been able to help with that and try it by implementing small fees like the local meals tax hadn't been adopted in the city. Every other community adopts it. That's going to yield close to $60,000 per month. It's estimated another $700,000 in new revenue coming in. We just recently adopted the mayor's trash fee that's going to affect multifamily households. Many communities have a trash fee. There'll be a sliding scale for that, and there'll be an exemption based on if your family lives in one of those units or not, but really geared toward the trash collection's been really expensive. It's about $6 million a year to get the trash hauled away. Many people are not utilizing the recycling as much as we would like them to, which costs us in tonnage, and there's a savings. The more people recycle, the better off we are, and the lower the price tag it is. I think that's down to about $5.5 million in the next year. trying to just contain costs on that. And you know that salaries, the pensions, and there's also issues around keeping public safety folks and City Hall folks working. You know, we've tried to avoid layoffs this cycle. We've been successful so far, and we're hopeful that we can cut this deficit even further, you know. So there have been budget issues around the city and for all the municipalities. I think across the state there's a whole $900 million deficit statewide. So we're no exception to that. We get hit hard when the local revenues are not adding up, and we can't, we gotta keep taxes affordable. We can't just go to the taxpayers and ask them to increase taxes. So we're in a situation where we've gotta be creative. We've gotta look outside the box and try and come up with remedies so that we avoid public safety layoffs.
You know, you mentioned that you went to the trash fee this year, and that is surprising that you've been able to go that long without it. Gloucester, for example, has had a trash sticker for years, and now we have these purple bags that cost $11.50 or something like that for five bags. But what we found is that once, you know, you went into that, the recycling increased two and threefold. The amount of tonnage that you have to dump goes down substantially with a good recycling program. So you're certainly on the right track, and wish you well with that. We've got about a minute left, and I just want to, what does the election look like coming up? Is it going to be a crowded field or too early to say?
Thank you for your input on what Gloucester does. That's very helpful as a comparable community as well on the recycling. But yeah, I mean, we're off to a great start. It's myself. There's three incumbents running, Buzzy Barton and Tong Net are my colleagues on the council currently. As you may know, there's an open seat with the exit of the departure of my good friend Dan Cahill, who's the state rep. He's not serving re-election. So there are a host of candidates running for the open seat, and you know, we're off and running. I've been here my whole life. I love Lynn. I teach. I work. I'm involved in the city. I'm getting the job done for everyone. I'm respectfully asking one of your four votes. You do get to vote for up to four councilor-at-large members, and the election, the primary, is Tuesday, September 12th, and the final will be Tuesday, November 7th. I guess I've carved my niche out as being a tireless worker, Josh, and an advocate for our city. I'm trying to bring a different approach to city government. I do care about people, their quality of life in Lynn. And I want to attract hardworking families and new businesses to Lynn and make sure that we have adequate public safety personnel and equipment in our DPWs and our police and fire departments while we're continuing to obviously keep taxes affordable for the average homeowner. So we're excited to run again. There is competition out there, but we're trying to stay above that competition and work really hard to earn people's support again in 2017.
Well, great. I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now. One quick question. We had a guest on here a few months ago, Susan Kelly, who does a lot of work with beautifying Gloucester and created a nonprofit to improve the aesthetics of the public gardens in Gloucester. But she and her husband run a software company that does all of the labor contract. It pulls all data together for all of the labor contracts for teachers in most of the United States. I wonder if you know them or if you've done business with them.
I don't offhand. I don't recall hearing of that name, but I know of some of the work that's done on the community effort side. We're doing similar things with Patron City, with that Beyond Walls initiative I mentioned, and beautification and, you know, building of community gardens. And one of the community benefits agreement with the Beacon Chevrolet site, the North Harbor site, was that they had to put in a recreational park and playground along with the boardwalk in our downtown where the farmers market is. So that's going to be like a $750,000 investment to the downtown. And on the teacher contract, I'm not exactly familiar with that kind of work, but I do know that there's cost, you know, there's, you can do costing out of contracts and things and vary it by municipalities and see where people are in negotiation. I'm happy to say since 2015, if not all of our units, municipal contracts are fully funded, and we've done a good job with personnel this cycle and getting people contracts, with the exception of the teachers. You know, teachers have been out 1 year, Josh, to this day. Today, their agreement expired. They've been working under an extension, and people are getting frustrated with that process. The schools have a budget that's been passed. We're hoping that the teachers get a fair and equitable contract soon, and I think Ms. Kelly's work could help to bring that to closure as well.
I'll connect you two up. Thank you for being on the program, and we'll look to talk to you later in the campaign cycle.
Always a pleasure, Josh. Thanks for having me on today.
Thanks,
Happy 4th, everyone.
Safe.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodwright double-hung insert window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodwright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is David Gardner, who I know from Rotary and has the distinction of being sworn in last evening as the newest district governor for District 7930. Includes some 47 clubs from Boston to north to Salem, New Hampshire, and east to the communities of Cape Ann. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Josh. How are you today?
Good, good. It was quite a ceremony last night. Wanted to get you right out of the gate before you get into all of your things that you, a governor has to do. Tell us what the experience was last night and you know, what the horizon looks like for the coming year for you.
So last night was about celebrating the people of Rotary. The new term in Rotary that they're kicking off a marketing campaign is People of Action. And the people... members of our Rotary clubs around the district and really around the world have had so much impact on people's lives locally, regionally, and internationally that I really want them to shine. And that's the people who have served in the past as district governors, as well as past members, past presidents, current and incoming presidents, and the total leadership team of our district to support their mission to making a difference in the world.
The I've used the analogy when I did the Rotary Radio Hour show years ago. I used to talk about the analogy of It's a Wonderful Life and the part where the angel takes the character that Jimmy Stewart played and shows him what his life would be like with if he didn't live. And I've used that and said, what would the world be like if Paul Harris had never started the whole Rotary movement? And when you look at the amount of good things that happen in 47 communities in just our section of the world in Rotary, it's pretty amazing stuff. And it was nice to be part of that celebration last night. Just the polar plunge as one thing, you know, that was kind of an off the path idea that Steve Cady trumpeted, and we took it and ran with it, but it's become an annual thing. And it's raised millions of dollars, close to $1 million from that one fundraising thing. What are some of the things that you'll be looking to do or champion on your shift as governor?
So one of the things that we're really focused on is a multi-year approach is to deal with the hunger and homelessness situation that exists in eastern Massachusetts within our towns. And it's become, you know, a problem that we think we can actually solve over time if we can just get the resources and advocate effectively for people. And we demonstrated that last night at the installation. We had a gift basket for personal care products for both male and female service members who are living in one of the veterans facilities in Boston. And what was really cool was that was an in-event service project, and then we added a component to it. We raised almost dynamically, just shy of $3,000 to be able to use to augment with gift cards those contributions to those veterans, thanking them for their support and showing them that there are people who care. So that's one thing we're going to continue to do is in the homeless and hunger area. And then every year we have a signature event called the World Peace and Understanding Dinner. The last 2 years have been absolutely magnificent and what they've been able to accomplish in bringing some of the world situations forward has been very compelling. And last night we, you know, briefly honored a young man who was very involved in that project. We packaged almost 3 trailer loads of material to be sent to Syria to help with the relief efforts there. And that was an amazing experience. And this year My plan is to have the World Peace and STEM Dinner focus more on our own communities and deal with the opiate abuse problems that we have and that seems that all of us have or are likely to experience, unfortunately, over the next few years. And we need to do something about it because it's running rampant. And so we're going to bring the world peace conversation back to our local area and work some kind of a program similar to some of the in-plain sight and try to really bring about the awareness, the focus, remove some of the stigmas, and help each of us learn how better to spot those in need from either some concern and caring or a higher level support.
Great. And I know that Rotary International is looking to put the spotlight on the word action. So I know that the pictures that we present, we're trying to do show, you know, not just a bunch of people standing around or people at the party or whatever, but community service, where it touches what happens in each community. And that's an evolving process. Tell us a little bit about that.
And so what I think we've determined is that Rotary got away from its roots a little bit over the past decade or two, and this is not necessarily global, but it's somewhat true, that we've gotten into a check-writing organization. And I think that newer members, especially millennials, want to have hands-on service. And the feel-good aspect of that possibility is what really builds vibrant and committed and collaborative clubs. So we're moving in every event we do to try to bring in an element of service and to try to allow clubs to, along with district grants, which are the way when we donate to the Rotary Foundation, half of that money comes back to our districts for local support. And that can then help augment club investments in community service projects. But we've also restructured our budget a little bit on the district level to allow for more mini grants. And we did one last year for helping clubs buy diapers wholesale for homeless shelters and food pantries, since that is an item that they cannot use vouchers for at all. And it's for a young family, diapers can be a very expensive proposition. So, you know, we're trying to do those things that can allow people to do more hands-on work, and that was evidenced clearly in the slideshow last night. And yeah, we need to keep pushing that because I think that's what will attract new members. And in my membership plan, it is specifically about engaging people to experience Rotary and Rotarians and the good work we do and the joy that we actually get out of serving others. And with that, I think membership will increase almost organically.
When I worked with Dave Clifton, who was the zone coordinator for Zone 32 for Public Image, he would tell the story that when his father was a Rotarian or when his father's time, you didn't talk about the good things Rotary did. It was something you did, and it was almost like the elves came out in the middle of the night and did it. Everybody knew it was Rotary, but you didn't pound your breast and say that. And he says, not that we're trying to pound our breasts and say, look what we did, but that people, as you know, we're past the centennial celebration of Rotary, but as that was approached, and the people asked the question, would we be here for another 100 years? And one of the things that came out of those summits and those hearings were, gee, maybe we need to do a better job letting people know who we are. You know, Swami used to tell the story about, you know, what is Rotary? And Rotary to some people was a traffic island. It wasn't what the organization is. So, right. I agree that, with you that the sense of putting forward actionable things and creating that picture should do a lot to enhance Rotary. And I thought your message last night when you gave your acceptance speech was very clear and certainly articulated the direction that not simply you're looking to go to, but how that coincides with the mission of Rotary International.
Thank you, Josh. I think that really we have to, like, not brag about Rotary, but clearly be known as the people who do service in the community that make a difference to those who need us. And I think in doing so, we will attract people. And I really ask your listeners, if you're not familiar with Rotary or you're not familiar with our work, consider going to a Rotary Club meeting and getting involved with a service project. We now have multiple membership options that allow people to, you know, be a full member for one cost, and a satellite club member or a service club membership, which is at a lower cost and requires less meeting time but more service time. We also just have fans of Rotary, people who want to share in our mission but don't necessarily at this time want to be a member, and they can virtually pay as they go. And the, really what we want is to collaborate with other organizations and other people to create more feet in the street to make more impact. And as we do that, we will gather strength. We will create more impact and make communities better for everyone, you know, not just for some. And so that's my request, is people, you know, share Rotary and allow people to experience the good that comes out of Rotary, and hopefully it will impact each of those people individually. So it's much easier to be in Rotary now than it was.
You know, there was a there's merit in listing or putting together a package that shows what happens in each community because of Rotary. And we were sitting around at the table last night, and John Morris, our longtime treasurer, leaned over and said, the amount the Gloucester Club will have given this year exceeds $100,000. Between local efforts and international efforts, $100,000, like $107,000 or something like that is the number. When I was president, what, 6 or 7 years ago, it was around $57,000. So that's just, it keeps growing. And
that's only part of it, Josh. I mean, if I looked at on average, it's probably $30,000 to $40,000 per club for charitable contributions and scholarships, clearly. So you're talking, you know, do the math, the times 47, 48 clubs.
Yeah.
And that's a huge number, but it's not, that's not even the biggest number and the biggest impact. Our biggest impact is in service, in direct service to people.
Sweat labor, sweat equity.
You start adding 30, 40, 50 hours for every member in the district, and we have 1,800 plus members. That's huge. And one of our incoming President Ian Risey's goal for next year is to actually be able to tabulate dollars donated and service hours rendered to be able to make a worldwide statement of the impact of Rotary to encourage people to join us in our service projects. So I think that's all what we need to do. We need to just demonstrate that this is the organization to be in. And not that the organizations aren't great, because I would hope that we can collaborate with them as well in joining forces. And many towns do that. You know, whether it be Rotary and Kiwanis or Rotary and Lions Club, or Rotary and any other nonprofit organization, we're stronger connected than we are disconnected. So there's a lot of conversation in my plan for this year, as has been in planning for this year, of collaboration with other clubs, with other districts, with other organizations. And I think if we can succeed in that, we can move a lot of the conversation forward and find more efficient ways to provide impact.
I noticed in your remarks last night you talked about membership development, and one of the things that you spoke of it is, hey, if you go through your contact list, and it may not be, you know, everyone's contact, you know, everybody is in a different business and does different things, but they have a contact list that's not necessarily geographically the same as our district Rotary, but just go through it and look at people who might be a good person to be in Rotary. What that would do if everybody found two people. And I thought that was that was a really interesting point to convey, and I hope that people listen to that, and those who are listening in our audience do that. And it doesn't just have to be Rotary. It could be any organization out there. Go on your LinkedIn group or your Facebook and find two people that would like to be involved in the community in some manner, whether it's Rotary or Lions or Kiwanis or what have you. It will help. The rising tide would lift all boats, if you will.
That is so true, and I think that part of that idea, Josh, actually came from you about looking at your social media connections, and I think I've taken it to a little bit different level in trying to get people to refer back into clubs or invite them specifically to go visit a club. And you know, my goal is clearly, if everybody could do two in 1,800 people, even with only a 10% success rate, it'd be well in excess of 300 new members in our district. which would be phenomenal, and increase the worldwide from 1.2 to 1.5 million members in total. So I think that's where we're going to gain our strength. And one of the issues when you ask people to join your local club is sometimes it changes the dynamics of your participation and or the club's participation. And I think some people think twice about bringing and changing their club, but it's really we're one Rotary, and we need to stop defining lines of clubs. Although everything happens in a club, the club is required for management of its team, of its budget, of its service projects. We need to blur the distinction between clubs, and that we're really all on the same mission to make the world a better place. And I think if we can do that, it will provide more opportunities for people across club lines. So if one club is doing a project on eye care and people have a specific passion for eye care, they can do work with that club and not be limited to the projects their own club offers. And,
well,
and
I wanna...
same thing outside of organization. I think it's about total impact. And one of my goals is that when my presidents, the presidents of 2017-18, to complete their term, is that they stay involved either at the club level, at the district level, or take on a more meaningful participatory environment in a local nonprofit.
Yeah.
That continues the bigger mission. So, to me, it's about, you know, what's next, you know, as a springboard to the future.
I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and we certainly wish you the very best in your new year as the governor for the local Rotary District. Take care.
Thank you very much, Josh.
Thank you, David.
Pleasure to be here.
Right.
Bye-bye.
All right, there you go. Fast hour once again, and got these mics totally backwards today. But Trending Now, heard most Fridays here on MSO News Sports. I believe we're back next week.
We're back next week.
Okay, what do we have?
I don't have the lineup yet, but I've got it's filling in fast. So you'll know by probably the 4th of July what next week looks like, or the next couple of weeks look like.
All right, Trending Now with Josh Arnold. I'm Rick Moore, our producer and engineer, Bill Kapowski. Have a great weekend.